This is Resonance 104.4 FM and you're listening to The Bike Show. We are 9 days into the Tour de France, and what a 9 days it's been. And if you follow the Tour with the kind of patriotic fervour that we have here at the Bike Show, how good has it been for the British contenders? The men in black, the men racing for the Sky Team. We've seen Mark Cavendish looking good in the rainbow hoops of world champion winning a stage. We've seen Chris Froome winning yesterday in the hills of Switzerland. And today, Bradley Wiggins wearing that yellow skin suit, extending his lead in the general classification. On the show this week, we're not going to be talking about this year's edition of the Tour de France. We're going to be talking about the Tour de France as a whole, taking the long view of the race, if you like. Of course, it's a race that goes back to 1903, the first time it was held, and it's a race that is so much more than a sporting spectacle. And to help me in such a task, I have a uniquely well-qualified expert guest. Christopher Thompson is Professor of History at Ball State University in America, and he is the author of The Tour de France, A Cultural History, which came out a few years ago and is an excellent academic study of what the Tour de France means in cultural, political, economic, commercial terms beyond what it means purely as sport. He started by telling me how his interest in cycle racing had begun at a very early age while he was living in Belgium.
My father was a diplomat, an American diplomat, and when I was just shy of my 12th birthday in the early 1970s, he was posted to Brussels, Belgium. And I went to a French school at the time, and so I could speak French. And I discovered the extraordinary sport of bicycle racing at a time when the greatest cyclist in the world, Eddy Merckx, a Belgian, was at the height of his powers. And so I was just absolutely transfixed, and I watched as many races as I could on Flemish and French language TV in Belgium. I bicycled to school and back whenever the weather permitted, which was most of the time. And so I just became very aware, bought bicycling magazines, read about it in the local press. And so my interest in the sport goes back to my teenage years as a fan.
And did you race yourself in those days?
No, I did one little novice race when I went off to boarding school, my second to last year in high school. And then as an 46-year-old, I got back into the sport and have done a couple of races in my late 40s, and I've done a fair amount of cycling in the Pyrenees over some of the great climbs. So I'm an avid cyclist at my own level at just shy of 53, but not a competitive cyclist.
Right. So I can understand, and many people will be able to understand, why a sports scientist, for instance, might want to study the Tour de France. But a historian, and especially a historian interested in society, what does this sporting event tell us about society? When did you realize that there was an interesting subject there to be investigated further as a historian rather than as a teenage cycling fan?
That's right. That's a great question. I was in graduate school at New York University and searching around for a dissertation topic. And a noted cultural historian from France who was teaching at NYU early in my time there happened to be teaching a course on 20th century French culture. And in the course of a lecture on the 1930s, he made a sort of throwaway comment about the 1930s having been the great popular era of the Tour de France bicycling race. And I remember leaving that seminar room, I'm sure I was the only graduate student leaving, thinking, oh my gosh, there's a topic there, that this was not just something that I'd been interested in 15 years earlier as a teenager, but that there was something about the Tour de France that might sort of project a new perspective on 20th century French history, so social history, cultural history, politics, even economic and commercial history. And so I began to delve into the subject as sort of preliminary research my third year of graduate school in France, made some contacts over there with scholars. It had hardly been researched or written about at all by academic scholars. Of course, there were lots of picture books and journalistic accounts that often had nuggets of information that that I used to sort of follow up on certain issues. But nobody had done a kind of rigorous archival press analysis as I chose to do. But as the more I read, the more I realized that this would be a unique way of understanding a number of really important issues in 20th century French history.
What kind of things were you setting out to look at? Because obviously France is a big country, the 20th century is a long time.
Right. So as I began to do some reading and as I began to look at what historians call primary sources, so press accounts from 100 years earlier, novels written about cycling, even TV coverage or radio coverage I listened to, what I began to realize was that the Tour de France had been an event held annually that allowed the French to think about and to represent ideas about a number of really key issues in their 20th century history, such as gender roles, class relations, national identity, local identity. For example, the itinerary, after all, it is the Tour de France. The itinerary initially espoused the frontiers of France. It was a way of marking the national territory shortly after the French had actually lost a couple of provinces in the east after the Franco-Prussian War. And those provinces had been taken over by the Germans. So it really became a symbolic way of outlining the nation, of showing what parts of Europe were part of France and what parts were on the outside of the Tour and therefore outside of France. Local communities, when they were part of the itinerary, could use the Tour coming through their community as a way of showing that they belonged to this larger thing, the nation of France. Regions that were left out of the Tour in the early decades for years in a row would often feel humiliated, angry, resentful, because they understood the symbolic importance of the race in defining who was part of the country and who wasn't, and they would feel resentful at having been excluded year after year by the organizers. And so that, I have a whole chapter in the book I wrote that looks at the ways in which the itinerary itself became a symbol of the national community.
Because bicycle racing was young but fairly well established in 1903 when the first Tour de France was held, yet somehow this race captured the imagination in a way that no other race did. Was there something about the time? Were people aware of war brewing? Obviously, war having just been fought in the latter part of the 19th century. What was the ideological, political climate at the time that meant that some newspaper organizing a bicycle race around the country was going to meet with such success in convincing people that this was an interesting spectacle beyond perhaps just the sport?
Well, you're asking a critical question. Where we are 11 years before the outbreak of World War I, and tensions are mounting in a very polarized Europe. The early 1900s were a time of significant nationalist fervor in France, with politicians and the public obsessed about a war of revenge against Germany for the Franco-Prussian defeat of 1870. And so there's a tremendous amount of emphasis on military preparedness. Nobody knows when the war will break out, but it's becoming increasingly clear that with tensions mounting, a war at some point is going to occur. Germany had a larger population, a renowned military, and so sport in general and cycling in particular became a way of preparing the French youth, young French boys and men, for the revenge against Germany. And as a result, particularly because cycling was already well established as a sport, both track cycling in velodromes and long distance endurance cycling, when the organizers of the Tour de France had the idea to create the longest race in the history of the sport in 1903, they were able to do so in a political context that favored endurance events that were believed to prepare youth for the kinds of difficult situations they would encounter in war. It would toughen them. It would give them the endurance, the courage that they would need to defeat the Germans in a future war. But they also were able to rely on the fact that the sport was one of the most commercially supported sports in the Western world at the time, because tire companies and bicycle companies had every reason to support the sport as a way of promoting their product lines. And there were a network of, again, track races and road races throughout many regions of the country. And so they could found the race on the established popularity of the sport and then the political or ideological imperative of preparing young men for military action.
So this sounds quite warlike and nationalist. Was there a sort of left-right split over the Tour de France? Did the organizers of the Tour de France come from one political tradition, and how did the others view them?
Yes, the newspaper that founded the Tour de France was created in 1900, just a few years before the race was created. It was created by right-wing nationalists. The Dreyfus Affair had just concluded, and this was an affair, complicated affair, in which a Jewish French officer had been unjustly charged with treason, and the French left had gradually taken up his defense and had ultimately prevailed, but the French right had defended the army, which had falsely convicted this officer. And as a result, France was very much divided. There was already a very popular sports daily at the time that had been created by somebody who'd been on Dreyfus's side and who refused to run advertisements for companies whose owners had been against Dreyfus. And as a result, they coalesced and founded their own sports daily, and they used the Tour de France's popularity ultimately to defeat their rival. And so one has to understand that at that time, France was an extremely divided, polarized country. At the same time, what the actual people who organized the Tour de France for this newspaper wanted to achieve was to unite the country. So while the sponsors, the funders, had been involved in this very heated debate over Dreyfus's innocence or guilt and the role of the army in unjustly charging him and sentencing him, the actual organizer of the race, who probably was of right-wing beliefs, but what he hoped to do with the race was use it to unite the country. The itinerary would literally geographically unite the country, but also the heroic performances of the Tour de France racers would provide a model of courage that the whole country could get behind. And so his vision was very much of a unifying vision, even if the race was born in a very polarized context.
So let's talk a little bit about the races in those early days. They must have been tough guys. It was a very demanding race, more demanding, you might say, than the race today. Certainly longer stages and less support, heavier bicycles, worse roads and all the rest of it. Who were they and how were they represented? And was that accurate?
Well, I was able to do a kind of sociological study of generations of racers. And what I discovered was that almost all of them in the early decades of the race came from urban environments. So they came from towns and cities. They tended to be either working class or very modest lower middle class. So we're talking about shop clerks, mechanics, young men helping out in a variety of workshops, occasionally some factory workers, although they weren't typically very represented in the early races because I don't think they had enough money to buy a bicycle. They didn't have the free time to train. And then gradually over the decades, the demographics of the contenders, of the race participants, shifted and became somewhat more rural. And so it was boys from the countryside beginning in the 30s and 40s. And you still get, of course, kids from cities and towns. But the popularity of the sport gradually seeped out throughout France and even into sort of isolated hamlets and out to the countryside. But initially, it was an urban phenomenon. And I would say sort of the artisanal class and sort of clerks, people with a little bit of disposable income so that they could purchase a bicycle, had some free time to train, and were close to races, whereas young men out in the countryside didn't tend to have as much disposable income and were somewhat isolated. As a result, the organizing newspaper did create an image of these racers as what they called ouvriers de la pédale, workers of the pedal. They presented them as tireless, efficient, obedient, well-disciplined workers. And they presented them both as sort of artisans and also disciplined modern factory workers. So work was very much central to the image that was generated about Tour de France participants in the early decades of the race up until World War II.
And so it was being used to emphasize particular kinds of virtues in the population.
That's exactly right. This is a time of factory strikes, class conflict repeatedly in the early 20th century as workers contest the work conditions of increasingly modern, rationalized factories. And as a result, the organizers, who after all represented major business interests, in other words, the funders of the newspaper that organized the race, they themselves had thousands and thousands of workers. They saw it as a way of projecting a positive image, what they saw as a positive image of workers who were disciplined, obedient, well-behaved, and in fact were continually being fined for inappropriate behavior, just as workers in factories were continually being fined for being late or for fighting or for being disobedient to the foreman. So it became kind of a mirror image of the factory. At least that's how it was being presented in the organizing newspaper.
Because the riders were not always happy with how they were being treated. So there was a certain amount of conflict there, and they were not always happy with the way the race was being run. There's some quite interesting anecdotes in your book about resistance and rebellion in the peloton, which I suppose has continued right up through to the modern day. I mean, you know, now it's more about things like, oh, should we be allowed to have radios or should we be allowed to not wear bicycle helmets? But there's always been that kind of tension, hasn't there?
That's exactly right. The issues may change, but it is a place of work for the racers, and it is a very difficult place of work. The sport was extremely hard in the past. It's probably a little bit easier today, but it remains one of the toughest sports that you can do. And as a result, if you're a professional and you feel that a difficult sport is being made more difficult by the organizers, you will seek, and they did seek, and they continue to seek, to organize themselves, and either through spontaneous action, slowing down the race or striking at the beginning of a stage after a stage where they were very upset at the conditions that were too dangerous or too harsh, or if a particular racer gets penalized unfairly, perhaps his teammates will refuse to start the next day. There was a very celebrated case in 1924 when the defending champion, Henri Pélissier, arguably the most popular athlete in France at the time, and his brother dropped out of the race. He was the defending champion. It made huge press coverage. He dropped out of the race, and he was probably towards the end of his career. He was probably not in the best possible condition. He may have been looking for an excuse to drop out, but that said, he dropped out because at the time the race organizers would require that you finish a stage with all the equipment that you'd started the stage with. And at that time, they were starting in the middle of the night because the stages were extremely long. It took them a long time to complete them by the mid-afternoon, which is when the stages were scheduled to finish. And so in the middle of the night, even in the summer in France, it might be quite chilly. Racers often wore several jerseys, and they gradually peeled them off over the course of the day as the day heated up. Henri Pélissier, this defending champion, had done just that. He put on several jerseys and gradually tossed jerseys away on the side of the road as the day heated up. That was actually a violation of tour regulations, which required, again, as I mentioned earlier, that you finish the race with everything that you'd begun it with. And he was outraged that he was not allowed to dispose of his own personal property in any way he wished. And so this generated a huge controversy that was covered by the political press across the spectrum in France in 1924, and that ended up connecting with a broader debate about exploitative, brutal conditions in modern factories in France. And so that's a good illustration of how work conditions in the Tour could create a strike or some kind of contestation on the part of a few racers. And if the racers were prominent enough, the political press got a hold of it and had some fun with it, connecting it to broader issues. And so the communist press in particular took the organizers of the Tour to task for brutally exploiting what they called the cycling proletariat. And so the Tour de France became immersed in the class conflict of the day.
And so turning to the post-war era, what were the political undercurrents that affected the Tour, and how did the Tour in turn project its own vision and its own beliefs and its own ideologies onto wider society?
I suppose one could begin an answer to that question with the question of the itinerary again. After World War II, you had the imposition of the Iron Curtain between communist Eastern Europe and a free capitalist Western Europe, or social democratic Western Europe, but a free democratic Western Europe. And you had the beginnings of what today is the European Union. In the 1950s, attempts to get a number of Western European countries to coordinate their economic and industrial efforts so that they could all improve their economic prospects after a horrifically destructive war, of course, but also to guarantee an enduring peace between France and Germany, who, after all, had fought three wars in the space of a lifetime. In about 75 years, they'd fought three wars. And so in that environment, the Tour de France, the new Tour de France organizers embraced European integration, and far more than they had before World War II, they began to export the itinerary of the Tour to neighboring countries. And so the Tour de France, in a sense, became, within certain limits, of course, logistical limits, the Tour of Western Europe, and it began to visit Switzerland and Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, Italy, West Germany, even England for the first time across the channel in the 1970s. I remember that well. I was living in Belgium at the time, as an attempt to show that symbolically that Western Europe was on the path to a kind of peaceful, collaborative unification, and that the Tour de France was going to symbolize that by exporting itself. So the imperative of the pre-World War I era in particular of marking the territory to symbolize the wrong that had been done France when Alsace and Lorraine had been amputated from it by the victorious Germans in 1870, that imperative had completely been reversed after World War II. And now what the objective of the organizers was simply to reflect what they saw as a positive process of increased harmonious development between Western European countries.
That's fascinating. And so we also have, I guess, the sexual revolution of the 50s, I suppose, and 60s in the post-war era, more women working, women being regarded as increasingly the equals of men. But that was not something that the tour embraced at all, really, was it? They had very clear ideas of what a man's role was and what a woman's role was. And they're quite old-fashioned in the way we look at it today.
I would argue that cycling remains one of the most masculine sports bastions in sport today. To understand why, one has to understand, again, that in the early decades of the sport, it was seen as a particularly important way of forging a particularly virile, hyper-masculine, heroic figure. They were referred to as giants of the road from the early days of the race. And so tour participants, even when they finished last, were still perceived as superhuman figures because of their courage, their endurance, and their resistance to extraordinary suffering. Suffering was one of the great themes in tour coverage, in cycling fiction, and as a result, the image of the heroic cyclist who goes up mountains and braves hot temperatures and even snow at times in the mountains, not to mention his rivals, that figure of the giant of the road was used to generate a particularly masculine, hyper-virile image of French manhood. And as a result, any women seeking to enter the sport were seen as potential threats who would undermine this male monopoly on virility. And so any attempts by women as a result of their increased opportunities, educational and leisure opportunities, professional opportunities, as the sexual revolution, particularly after World War II, got underway in the 60s, any attempt by women to break through that kind of conventional image of the tour as a male bastion of virility were seen as real threats to the tradition of the race and to the heroic image of the racers, because if women, typically seen and presented as fragile and vulnerable, were suddenly proving themselves capable of the same kinds of feats that had been monopolized and reserved for these heroic, hyper-virile giants of the road, then what did that mean about the race? What did that say about the race? Was it still the same thing? And so even though there has been a female Tour de France many years, not every year, but many years since the mid-1980s, it has not had anything like the kind of popularity. It's very marginalized when compared to things like women's tennis, women's gymnastics, women's ice skating, which are far more popular, get a good deal more media coverage in France, for example. And women's cycling is a very marginal sport, whereas male cycling continues to be extremely popular.
You mentioned the representation of athletic prowess and suffering and the difficulty of the tour. And that leads us, I suppose, onto the question of doping, which is fascinating, the story that you tell in your book, because it really is a story of a 180-degree turnaround. Right up until, I suppose, the mid-60s, it was part and parcel of the race, not something that necessarily was talked about very much, but it was not something that was heavily regulated. What drove the change? Because now we have very much an anti-doping culture, and anyone who's caught doping is thrown out and considered to be a cheat and a disgrace.
Well, it was a gradual evolution. Part of it was just ignorance. And as a result, from the very beginning of endurance cycling was such a tough sport that even in the 1800s, racers were experimenting with all sorts of strange concoctions. And I document this in my book, combinations of cocaine and liquor and any huge amounts of sugar, anything they thought might give them a particular kick, might reduce their suffering. Gradually, in the interwar era, doctors, the medical establishment in France and elsewhere, began to be concerned about this completely unregulated, unscientific recourse to various doping agents. But nothing was done. There were no regulations passed in sports federations. It remained, you know, a kind of mysterious, secretive, largely unacknowledged, but fairly widely known reality. World War II changed things, in part because amphetamines were massively used by all the armies combating in World War II to keep soldiers alert, awake, to keep Air Force pilots on long bombing missions alert and awake. And as a result, millions and millions of soldiers returned home after the war with stories about the impact of amphetamines and how it could keep you awake and improve your performance. Very quickly, that seeped through into society. You know, university students preparing for exams, taxi drivers, etc., began to use the stuff. And of course, it entered into the sports arena, and a sport like endurance cycling, like the Tour de France, amphetamines would provide a temporary but often critical help to a cyclist. As the drug problem became increasingly prominent, a greater and greater social issue, politicians in the West, in Western Europe, including in France and in the United States, began to focus on it in the 1950s. And their focus meant that they began to look at the kinds of models that young people were turning to as they decided to engage in amphetamine use and other drugs. And of course, the most prominent models were athletes, as they are today, one might argue. And so I think that the fact that athletes had been such prominent positive role models, despite the sort of largely hidden culture of doping, meant that once doping became a society-wide issue, particularly amongst the youth, and politicians turned their attention to it, they ended up focusing on role models. And they particularly focused on athletes, and they particularly focused, in France at least, on endurance athletes, and Tour de France racers were the most obvious example of those. And so in the 60s, country after country, the Olympic organizers, various federations began to take action. Laws were passed, regulations were passed by sports federations and the Olympic organizers. And the cat and mouse game really began in earnest in the 60s, which was doping tests of various kinds and various kinds of penalties if you were caught doping. And that cat and mouse game has continued for the last 50 plus years. About 50 years now, and what has changed is the sophistication of both the athletes who dope and the sophistication of the regulatory forces who have a very advanced laboratory and scientists to try to detect evidence of doping.
It's very interesting you made that argument, and it's not an argument that I've heard before, that it was in fact concerns about recreational use of drugs in wider society that made sports organizers start to be concerned about the use of performance enhancing drugs in their sports, because it's often regarded as something internal to the sport, or perhaps in the post-war era, something to do with the Cold War in sports and the fact that they were developing performance enhancing agents that were actually quite effective. Previously, they have been of limited actual use, even though people might have thought they were very useful, that they were getting a lot better at doping. And so it sort of became clear in the sport, internally to the sport, that they had to do something about that. But it's interesting that you come to a view that it's actually to do with a spillover from society's fears about what's happening to the youth of today.
There was also growing concern within cycling that there'd been some deaths or near deaths that were understood to be related to the use of various dangerous drugs, which could actually kill a man when he was in full effort, particularly on a hot day. So the most famous example was in the late 60s when a top English racer, Tommy Simpson, died on a very, very hot day during a climb, and he was found to have taken drugs. So it could be fatal, and there'd been near-fatal cases in the 50s. So it was increasingly being seen, because of the kinds of drugs that were being used in an unregulated fashion within the sport, it was being seen by some of the doctors as increasingly dangerous. But that you're right, that there's a broader social context, which is recreational use, but even professional use. Doctors who were taking speed to be particularly alert during long operations, so that there was a real sense we have to stop this at the level of all of society, and that means focusing on role models in particular.
For quite a while during the 60s, the argument was made by some people that actually what was needed was more careful medical supervision, not banning drugs.
This is a very complicated debate, and people continue, although less so now publicly, but you're absolutely right. In the 60s, even into the 70s, but particularly in the 60s when the doping testing was just getting underway, there were numerous experienced cyclists, including a five-time tour winner, Jacques Anquety, who made the case, look, we're professionals. We have one of the hardest jobs in the world. We know how to go about our business. We know how to prepare ourselves. So go ahead and regulate youth cyclists and amateur cyclists, but allow us to do our jobs. We will mentor young professionals as they come into our ranks. We'll teach them how to do it. But if you want us to race up and down five mountains in a single day on a very hot July day, then you must allow us to do so. And Jacques Anquety made this very famous claim that nobody's going to want to watch the Tour de France if we're doing it at 20 kilometers an hour, suggesting that the only way that these heroic feats were possible that so appealed to the public and thus made the sport commercially viable was if the athletes themselves were on drugs. Because otherwise, a normal human being, even a top athlete, would not be able to perform at a level that would create that sense of excitement.
Well, that's an argument that Jacques Anquety from the grave appears to have lost, although we still have the issue of doping in the sport, but we don't have athletes making that argument anymore, which is quite interesting. Finally, I want to ask you about something that isn't really in your book, which is about the relationship between France and the Tour de France today and looking forward. It's been a long time since France had a winner or even a top contender in the Tour de France for the general classification. Is that a problem?
I think it is a problem in terms of public interest in France. And the organizers are aware of it. To some extent, it reflects the fact that the French have been leaders in the anti-doping crusade, and so that French cyclists are perhaps the least able to circumvent the increasingly strict anti-doping regime that's been set in place. And so for a while, in the last decade and a half, two decades, the French cyclists who participated in the Tour were talking about a Tour that was being run at two speeds. There were the foreign cyclists who were still doping considerably and very effectively, and then there were the poor French cyclists. And so part of it may be explained by that. And as a result, fewer and fewer top French athletes have gone into the sport because they don't see that they will really be able to compete. So I take your point. I think that there is an issue domestically. It still does very well on TV coverage, but I think that what has changed in the last three decades or so is that it's become, with changes in telecommunications, with economic globalization, it has become a truly global event, not just a French event or a European event. And so you have huge multinational corporations getting involved in sponsorship. Every part of the race just about is sold to the highest bidder. And so it remains an extraordinarily viable commercial venture, even if the public in France casts at times a rather jaundiced eye with all the doping scandals, with the lack of a top French racer who can truly compete for the yellow jersey. They have to settle for stage wins, the occasional exploit, but not a real contender.
But yet, the Tour de France is still doing its job of telling people a story of France.
I think it's still quite popular with casual fans who would never watch any other cycling race in France during the season, but then who watch the Tour de France because they love watching the mountains and the beautiful countrysides and the castles, and the coverage on TV is often has a very touristy kind of aspect to it, because when nothing's going on, the TV commentators will very often point out that such and such a castle that the racers are going by was the site of a great battle, or King Louis the 11th visited this chapel in this year. So I think it still holds, I know it still holds that kind of appeal for the casual observer who will tune in simply because it still remains the premier sporting event in France, but also because it projects this beautiful light on their own country, and they learn stuff about their own country.
And indeed, other people around the world learn something about France themselves. I mean, France remains, we were talking about it on the show just a couple of weeks ago, the most visited country in the world.
Exactly. Tourism, that's right. France gets more tourists than any other country in the world. And the Tour de France plays a role in projecting an extremely appealing image of the country, its geography, its traditions, its different regions, its diversity. And that is a very important selling point. And communities will bid for the right to host the tour because they now get international coverage of their community. So there's a famous climb in the Alps called L'Alpe d'Huez, very, very famous, which was first climbed in 1952. The reason that community was included in 1952 was because it had just opened as a ski resort, and the municipal council wanted to project a very positive image and get the word out, look, in the summer it's beautiful, but in the winter it's a wonderful ski resort. And so different regions, different cities and towns will use the tour to remind people or to inform the greater public, and now it's an international public, that they remain a lovely place to visit.
And turning to your own country, we have the case that's been brought by the US anti-doping agencies against seven times winner of the Tour de France, Lance Armstrong, who more than anybody brought the race to an American audience. If that case that the US authorities are bringing is successful from their point of view, and Lance is found to have doped during those victories, if that happens, then I suppose he may have his titles taken away from him. Could you see that playing out badly for the Tour de France in America?
I think that there is a core of cycling aficionados throughout the country now, sparked actually first by Greg LeMond, and then, of course, confirmed, reinforced by Armstrong's seven victories. I think that there is a considerable amount of, there's some denial still, but there are plenty of people who admire cyclists and will admire them whether they discover that even seven-time winner Lance Armstrong doped. They have sort of made their peace with the fact that it is a sport in which doping is still probably very generalized, in which it's still very easy to evade a lot of the anti-doping tests. And so that I think the public has had time, and this may actually help, should Armstrong be found to have doped, this may actually help him because the public has had time to digest the fact that just about every top racer that he defeated in his era has been found, has been implicated in a doping scandal. And so there's a sense that I don't think there'll be shock or surprise, there'll be disappointment, and it will be more interesting to see how this plays out with his image, his well-deserved image as a crusader against cancer. That complicates the image issue for him and for the public, because other athletes in the U.S. who've been found to have doped, the public has been able to simply reject them or continue to embrace them on the basis of their understanding of the sport. Armstrong's image, of course, transcends that. And so that he's a public figure on a level greater than any other athlete in the US.
I was in conversation with Christopher Thompson, professor of history at Ball State University. And his book, The Tour de France, A Cultural History, is published by the University of California Press. It's well worth tracking down. Thanks for listening to the show this week. Tune in again next week and enjoy the middle week of the Tour de France when it all gets serious as the race heads into the high mountains. Goodbye.